Welcome to Fantasy Feud, a pitcherless baseball podcast where we're tackling the most relevant debates in fantasy baseball each week. I'm Sarah Sanchez, and I'm here with my co-host, Shelly Verstrate, to talk through both sides of the hottest fantasy baseball debates right now with some of the greatest minds in the industry. Baseball is back. Games are ongoing. I was ready to strike an optimistic note here, and like 20 minutes before we started recording, we found out that Mike Trout has to have knee surgery, and I'm just dying over here. Shelly, how are you handling this news? How are your teams doing?
I'm not handling this news well, to be honest. I was very pessimistic about Trout coming into the season, but what he's done, I was in awe of what he was doing. He was running, he was hitting home runs, everything. And then, just like you said, 10, 15 minutes before we log on, the big news comes that he has a torn meniscus in his knee and he's going to have surgery. So we're all just, as we were prepping for this pod, we were all just talking, reeling, just be like, well, that sucks. Because it was just really good just to see Trout be, capital letters Trout again. And then he has this and it just really sucks. It really does.
It does. It truly sucks. I don't have Trout anywhere, mainly because I didn't see this version of Trout coming. It's not that I wouldn't have drafted him. It's just that it was always the wrong place. It was he was going the fourth or fifth round. I usually was taking a pitcher there or maybe a closer. And so I don't have Trout on any of my teams this season, but I was loving watching Trout be Trout. It really felt like we were getting that vintage Hall of Fame dude that we saw for years. I was so excited that Ron Washington had him running again. Just devastating. We're going to bring our guest today into this conversation, hear what he has to say about Trout and a whole bunch of other things. But we're so excited to welcome Ryan Bloomfield to the show. You know Ryan from his excellent work at Baseball HQ, where he's the associate editor of the absolutely essential baseball forecaster. It might just be the fantasy baseball Bible. He is also the co-host of one of my favorite pods, Bubba and the Bloom. And today we're going to pull some debate straight from the Bloom boards. Welcome to Fantasy Feud, Ryan. And how are you dealing with the Trout news?
I'm doing great. I'm not dealing with the Trout news very well. Although, however, it was pretty cool, Sarah, to see your face. And I'm glad you're patient enough to still have me on the podcast after you had said you've been offline all day, didn't know about the Trout news, and I started making up other guys who were injured. You have to look them all up.
So I was freaking out because you're still letting
me come on.
You did name one of the guys I do have in a pretty important team, and Kevin Gausman. And I was like, what do you mean Gausman's out for this?
I should have thought of a Cub. I don't know why I didn't think of a Cub, but.
I would have believed you on that too. Normally I'm on top of Cubs news, but today I've had this really important project at work. And so we have our biggest fundraiser next weekend in Miami. I've just been nose down in PowerPoint most of the day and doing meetings and calls. So I really, y'all could have told me just all the lies and I would have believed all of them.
I didn't push it too far. I just did one name and Shelly played along and I think it came out pretty good. So
I almost forgot to do we're all in Tout Wars. I almost forgot to do Tout Daily today. I was literally looking at my phone and saw the alert and I was like, oh yes, Tout Daily. It's Tuesday.
I forgot last week. Actually, Bubba, my co-host on Bubba and the Bloom, texted me as part of our Tuesday ritual because we have a show on Tuesday nights. And reminded me to get the lineup in before we start. So we did that. I don't think I have Trout in that lineup, but we'll see.
I do not have Trout in that lineup. I might have streamed against the Angels.
Always.
I feel pretty good about that right now. Ryan, we're so excited to have you on the show. And before we get into the rules of the road and the debates, I want to talk about some of your most recent Fab Market Watch column at Baseball HQ. If you're not over at Baseball HQ, you don't subscribe to this column, you absolutely need to, because Ryan does a great job looking at fab trends, who you should be in on, who you should be out on. I'd love it if you just talk us through the process of how you generate that column each week, because I find your advice to be super helpful. What is it that you're looking at to determine those guys you should be in on and guys you should be out on?
Well, thank you, Sarah. It's always hard. There's so many fab columns out there and you're never going and you're writing a column that, you may have a reader that is in a 10 team mixed league and the same reader who's in a 12 team AL only league or NL only league. So you're never going to satisfy all. what I do that I think is a little bit different with my column. So like the hardest thing is just like defining the player pool. What types of players, what types of names are you going to talk about? My biggest thing that I do is I pull the data from Fantrax, which has daily updated roster trends. So basically I pull the data on Monday, which obviously is a day after Fab. And then I start writing the column on Fridays. And so I re-pull the data on Fridays and see which players have jumped the most in ads that week. I think that, you know, since most weekly players have had their most recent Fab, I'm interested to see who has the market been adding throughout the week, because those names will probably be the most relevant that following Sunday. So that's how I, and then I kind of group it by shallow league, deep league, and like deep league, and try and appease everybody, but it doesn't always shake out that way. And then in true Bloomboard fashion, I have to have color coded, you know, numbers and all that kind of stuff on there. So, but yeah, basically take it from Fantrax, look at market trends. And we, at Baseball HQ, we have a starting matchup tool, which is pretty sweet in my opinion. And I use that for the highest rated matchups of the week for like starting pitchers that are, I think, under 50% rostered. So take kind of all that stuff together and put the column together on Fridays and Saturday. And to the detriment of my own teams, probably I spend more time on that dang thing than my own Fab, but it's a labor of love. I enjoy doing it.
We stan a color-coded spreadsheet on this podcast. It's one of my favorite visuals in the universe, and I love seeing it with the Bloomboards and on that market report. I wonder, I've noticed a couple of things that are different this season than last season specifically. I feel like we're not having that rush of rookie pitcher call-ups that we had last season, where it was like, oh, which starting pitcher are you going to drop $200 a fab on this week? That has seemed to die down a little bit this year. But I'm curious, what are you seeing in the market that is different this season in terms of trends or in terms of which players are going and who's been most valued?
I'm finding that. So yes, that's the biggest thing, Sarah, is like, it is that we don't have that constant flow of Yuri Perez, Tanner Bibee, Gavin Williams, Bryce Miller, Bobby Miller. Like, we don't have that, at least yet. Maybe Paul Skenes, Christian Scott, et cetera, can move that needle at some point. But we have not had the, you know, given all of the starting pitcher injuries that we have not had that kind of replacement level kind of influx into the market. So that's been a big thing. The other big change that I've noticed this year versus last year is the closers. Last year, the closer market was like so stagnant that it was very hard to find saves on the wire. This season, we obviously had so many injuries before the season even started, but we're also getting a lot more closer movement in 2024 than we did in 2023. So just like that, those have been the two biggest things. Really, hitters on the hitter side, that hasn't really changed too much, at least from what I've seen. But closers and the lack of exciting starting pitchers, like I picked up Ryan Feltner for a two-step this week, and that's not exciting, has been a big shift from last year.
Yeah, I got outbid on Jameson Taillon and Mitchell Parker and wound up with a $1 Taiwan Walker. And that was about as exciting as it's gotten in my starting pitcher fab life this week, this fantasy baseball season. Shelley, what about you? What are you seeing in these market trends? Or do you see something similar with the starting pitching and closing?
Yeah, honestly, yes. I mean, I've just been trying to, because I don't really like a lot of the starting pitchers that have been available outside, you know, Bailey Falter, Ryan Feltner, because they have like the amazing two steps, right? But they're not long-term ads. They're only just like 1 week ads. I've been just trying to avoid starting pitching because I've not been too enthused about any guy that I'm seeing. So I've been trying to get like the Garrett Clevengers and you know just AJ Minters, guys who are getting wins, getting strikeouts, and going kind of that route, because I'm just not excited about any of the starting pitchers that I've seen so far. So yeah, that's kind of the kind of route that I've been sadly having to go down.
It's a really interesting point about some of those guys who are just getting saves and wins because of their roles. I mean, the Cubs actually have had one of these closing carousels going on with Edward Alzolay losing that closing job early in the season, Hector Neris gaining the closing job, but the man has a negative K minus BB rate right now. So if Neris is your closer, I think you should make other plans. I think the Cubs should also make other plans. But one of the things that has been really intriguing about what they've done is they've been getting three innings from Keegan Thompson and he'll get a win or a save. They've been getting three innings from Daniel Palencia. He'll get a win or a save depending on the day, right? Like Ben Brown has done that role for them as he's been in the starting rotation or in the bullpen in a couple of places. How do you feel about those middle reliever sort of like high leverage guys? And are you picking up any of those in the absence of other options, Ryan?
Yeah, like this is probably the year of Reed Fraley is for the Mets. Reed Garrett sorry, for the Mets. Those types of middle relievers. I think Garrett already has 5 wins this season, which is absolutely wild. So that's always an option. The interesting thing that I've seen too, though, is despite yes, the back end of the starting pitcher pool has been really rough, and the injuries have been really rough. Despite all that, I was looking this up today, and this. Probably a whole different conversation, but starting pitcher ERAs are actually way down from the last couple of years. It had been like 4.3-ish in like 21-22. It's down to, I believe, 4.0 this season. I suspect it's the ball. We're making changes to the ball again, but it is interesting that despite all of the kind of top shelf starting pitcher injuries with the lack of kind of that backfill, starting pitching has actually been a lot better than it has in seasons past, which I just found interesting.
I wonder if I think it's definitely the ball. I mean, Jason Collette was on this show last week, was talking about some of the structural changes offensively. But I also wonder if these two things are related. Like part of the reason Reed Garrett is getting so many wins is because Mets pitchers are not going 5 innings or they're leaving the game before they have a lead. And so therefore some random reliever just pops up with the win. It's kind of a structural result of the way baseball is being played right now and guys not ever seeing the third time through the order.
The Sean Manaea hook on his last start, 4 2/3 with Reed Garrett coming in was, as a Sean Manaea manager, that was tough.
Yeah. Sean Manaea is a great example of this. We're going to hash out some similar issues through debates. If you're new to the show, The Rules of the Road, this is a debate podcast. So we take every issue and tackle it through many debates. Each person will get 3 minutes to make their case. The moderator role will shift. There will be a 2-minute question and answer period between the debaters. The moderator can also ask questions during that period. And each debater gets 1-minute rebuttals. And we are just going to dive right in. I think Shelley is moderating our first debate.
Yeah. So the Rockies, they are a team. They're not good. just basically, in case you did not know, FYI, the Rockies have not been good this year. They're just barely above the Marlins at this point. I mean, really, I feel really bad for the Marlins fans, but you know, Rockies, like they're just really not that great. So Ryan, you recently made the case that Rockies on the road post Mexico wasn't worth an investment. I'm kind of wondering, like, if the Rockies at home are worth that said investment. Again, it really depends on schedule and what type of league that you're in. Is it daily? Is it a weekly type of league? But have the Rockies reached a point where no park can save them? So I'm just going to just start the questioning off with you, Ryan. What do you think?
I'm gonna take the pro side of the Rockies here, and for a couple of reasons, 2 or 3 reasons here. One, I'm a big proponent of, so like, yes, they're a bad team. Agreed. Although, however, as we're recording, they just scored 5 runs against the Miami Marlins in the first inning. It was against Sixto Sanchez. So grain of salt. But I'm a big proponent of, you know, bad teams do lend themselves to playing time. In fantasy, this is the old, like, Jonathan VR, I believe, on the Marlins when they were just terrible and they let VR steal 6, maybe it was on the Brewers that year, but steal 60 bases or whatever, just did not care. Maybe, you know, last year with the Nationals and CJ Abrams just running crazy and didn't care. But for fantasy, for those individual players, it was actually a boon. So team lineup, team offense doesn't really matter too much to me. Like, yes, the Braves, for example, are a much better hitting lineup than the Rockies. It's not even close, but your Braves are already rostered. Your Rockies aren't. So that's always, and the Rockies always have, they don't really platoon much. So if you have like a 7-game week where the Rockies are all at home, they're going to play Brenton Doyle, for example, hitting second every single day. And when you stream that, I think that's valuable from a fantasy standpoint. So that's probably the biggest thing, is just like, just because the team is bad. Yes, the run scored and RBI opportunities may not be there, but I think the playing time is there. And that's when for fantasy, when we're streaming and trying to take advantage of Rockies at home weeks, that's one big thing. The other big thing that I'll mention is Coors Field itself. Baseball HQ, we did a study of monthly park factors a few years ago, and Coors Field was the biggest shift from pitcher-friendly to hitter-friendly park in April and May into the summertime in terms of park factors. So like Coors Field, and it kind of makes sense, and actually Sarah Wrigley was up there too. You see a lot of these games in like April and May, it's like snowing in Coors, and the ball just does not carry at all. Coors is actually like a pitcher park in April and May. It's just that bad. But monthly park factors, as we get into the summertime, warmer temperatures, that sort of thing, the carry at Coors is so much higher than it is, you know, in July, August, whatever, compared to April and May. So I think that enters the decision making a few times as well. We're early in the season. We think, oh, okay, the Rockies are bad again. Coors isn't really that great of a park. It's a lot better in the summertime. So I think for these next couple months, when we're looking at streamers and Coors, I think it's even more advantageous.
Yeah, and I think Coors is definitely going to be a very interesting discussion, at least the next couple of weeks, because they called up Hunter Goodman, last week? And then mm-hmm. they just caught up Jordan Beck. So we should see how Colorado is going to use these young guys. I mean, historically, like, you know, the last decade or so, right? They haven't really been eager to play the young guys. So it will be interesting to see what they do going forward. But Sarah, do you have another take?
I do at this moment in time, and I definitely hear Ryan on the park factors, and weather is such a big deal this time of year. I will never forget, the Cubs were playing a game in Colorado and it was literally snowing, and Miguel Montero's out there with his cell phone. He's just like, they're saying there's a window, guys. They're saying we are going to play. And I'm just like, it's one of the funniest videos I've ever seen on Twitter. It's still up there somewhere. If you don't follow Miguel Montero on Twitter, you've probably should follow Miguel Montero on Twitter because he's great. And that video is there and you should find it. So definitely the weather plays a huge factor here. And look, just full disclosure, when the Cubs are home and we're doing that tout daily business, I literally walk by the ballpark to see if the wind is blowing in or if the wind is blowing out as to whether or not I'm going to stack off the Cubs matchup that night. So take that as you will. That said, the Colorado Rockies this year are not, they're not scary. The reason they're calling up Hunter Goodman is because that's the best shot that they have, right? Like, this is not a team that you very much want to invest in. And I'm going to just take, they have the second worst WRC plus as a team at home this season with a WRC plus of 71. That means they're 29% worse than league average at Coors. They strike out 26.9% of the time at home. Their OPS is 708. As a team at home. And the only reason that's not the worst in the league is because teams like the White Sox and the Marlins exist. So I am the days when I'm just like, he plays for Colorado and half of his games are going to be in a great park. Therefore, I'm going to stream this guy or I'm going to pick him up and have him on my bench for a 7-game week are sort of over for me. And the real kicker here for me and the moment that I knew that the tables had turned for Colorado, I picked up Chris Bryant for like $15 in the Podcasters Odd New League a couple of years ago. And I remember getting into a bidding war on Chris Bryant with Paul Sporer and Justin Mason. And I won. And I was just like kind of trash talking a little bit. I'm like, that's a former MVP who's going to play in Coors. And it's been terrible, people. It's been absolutely awful because Coors didn't fix that former MVP. The days of Nolan Arenado being there and like making it worth your while or like Charlie Blackman's going to do a thing, I feel like they're kind of on a downward trend for the Rockies right now. Now we've got Nolan Jones on the IL. I mean, it's just kind of a disaster over there in Colorado when I'm out.
I hear you. However, like in so and maybe league size is a thing, but like I'm really just thinking in terms of streaming. So like, I'll go back to my Braves, even Cubs example, or even like even San Francisco Giants, for example, who platoon everybody. It's all about at-bats. It's all about playing time. And Sarah, you will, I think successfully argue that yes, it is, you know, it's not about all about at bats if the at bats, the quality of those at bats are terrible, which is basically the argument that you have laid out. But I think there are individual guys on the Rockies that you can stream in a given week, in a given home week. Like, so you do cite the kind of team-wide stats, but I think you are penalizing, you know, Elias Montero or Brenton Doyle, who again are not great players. I'm not saying that. But in weeks where they're at home, they're going to play every day, hit second, hit fifth, whatever. Might be penalizing those guys for like a Jacob Stallings, a Jake Cave, Alan Trejo, those guys who are truly awful and not streamworthy in fantasy, who are dragging down Colorado's team average.
That's a good point. I mean, I am certainly, there are a handful of guys, and Brenton Doyle was in a couple of my waterfalls this week. I think he's a good player, and I think that the bat can do damage, and I'm interested. Look, if you just lost Tristan Cassis and you're trying to find a first baseman, right, you could do a lot worse than Hunter Goodman, right? Like, Matt Mervis was probably out there in a handful of leagues if people weren't stashing him, but like, you could do a lot worse. First base is kind of bare to find a guy. So Hunter Goodman, by all means, see what happens. But I think that, and Ryan, maybe I'll just ask you this question since we're in the question and answer period. Like, I look at a team like the Washington Nationals, and they have bad players who are going to play every single day versus the Rockies. And I kind of am more interested in the guys on the Nationals. Like, give me the Jesse Winker bounce back, or give me the chance that like Trey Lipscomb is a real thing over whatever guy the Rockies call up and break.
Yeah, Winker's a good example. I like that. And I would have pushed back on that, Sarah, and said, well, Winker's a platoon guy, but he's not.
Not anymore.
It hasn't been this year. And again, maybe that's because the Nationals are so bad that that Winker is, at least while he's healthy, going to play. But the Nationals, I mean, just to go down that kind of rabbit hole, they do have like Luis Garcia, Eddie Rosario, who are platoon guys. And so, and again, if you're looking to stream hitters on a weekly basis and you've got platoons, it's just so hard to get those at-bats. And I think that's one of the kind of, I don't know, hidden features, I guess, of Colorado, is they just, maybe they don't know about platoons. I wouldn't be sure. Would it really shock you if the Colorado front office did not know about platoon advantages? For whatever reason, pretty much their starting lineup is their starting lineup every day. And again, you at least know you're going to get those at bats. And in any given week, you kind of subject yourself to that variance, and good things can happen. But I do hear you on the Jesse Winker call. I think that is a good one.
It's really, I'm sorry to laugh so loud. I truly was like, I don't know, man. Have we ever seen Colorado successfully deploy a platoon? Hey, that may just not be a thing that they're doing in Colorado.
We may need to talk to them about this thing called on base percentage.
Let's talk about lefty righty splits. Exactly. Ryan, we should be the analytics department in Colorado. That would be great.
they just need to come to First Pitch Arizona for a weekend and learn some things from us, maybe.
Seriously, they could hire like half the presenters and just fix Colorado instantaneously. I think Shelley, are we in the rebuttal period? Did we exhaust the question and answer time, or where are we at?
No, yeah, y'all, if y'all have rebuttals, go ahead. I just really just want to say, just to put my thoughts out there, I think Colorado stinks. Like, their entire lineup stinks. Tovar swings too much. Doyle is okay. Ryan McMahon is all right. Outside of that, I really don't care. I don't really care that they hit at Colorado. I mean, I've had Charlie Blackmon because he was basically free in drafts. And he basically did nothing this week, being at Colorado and at Mexico City. I'm just so tired of Colorado. I'm like, I don't even, like, they're at least with, like, let's just say the Nationals, there are some interesting guys. Like, when I look up and down the Rockies lineup, I'm just like, I don't want, outside of Ryan McMahon, maybe, I don't even want to deal with the conflicts of the back and forth for the off chance that this guy gets hot at Colorado. It's honestly, it's not worth my heartburn.
It's an interesting point, and then I'll let Ryan go. One of the things that did occur to me as I was preparing for this debate was the Rockies were bad in Mexico City. Do you have any idea how bad your offense has to be to not be able to hit in Mexico City? Like, that is the best offensive environment maybe of all time in all of baseball, and the Rockies looked bad there. Ryan, go ahead.
Two game sample. Don't when it's 85 degrees in Denver this summer and Colorado goes off on a run scoring binge, I will be texting you both, rubbing it in. That's how I'll conclude that one.
Awesome. I think that we are right at the time for a quick break for our sponsors. We're going to take that quick break. On the flip side, we are back with so many more debates. Y'all will not want to miss it. And I think Ryan's going to moderate our next debate. But first, a quick break. All right. We are back. Ryan, I'm going to turn it over to you.
All right. The age-old question, and even more so in 2024 than in previous seasons, to stash or not to stash, especially in leagues like the NFBC, where you do not have IL slots, those roster slots, you only get seven. You already have a couple guys who are already most likely injured. Last week, you guys talked about Jordan Walker with Jason Collette on there. Today, it's Jackson Holliday, who came up with much aplomb, was already stashed in a bunch of leagues, struck out, I think, in 50% of his plate appearances, give or take, and was sent back down. So if you have Jackson Holliday, and we'll kind of, you guys can take it how you want here in terms of Holliday himself, but also this kind of, stashing in general as a strategy. Are you stashing Jackson Holliday, or are you cutting bait given how crowded the Orioles lineup is right now? I will start with Sarah.
This is so hard because I really believe in Jackson Holliday. I took him in the first pitch Arizona Rookie League draft with my first overall pick, and I was kind of surprised he got to me. I think I was picking third in that draft, and I was just like, oh my gosh, two guys went before Jackson Holliday. This is my lucky day. And then he really did look a little bit overmatched at the plate when he came up. He's striking out 50% of the time. He looked like he was pressing. My bigger concern here is not the talent. I trust that Jackson Holliday is going to figure it out someday. And how many prospects have we watched come up and in their first go at the big leagues, they look a little overmatched and they just look like they're struggling. And the question is, how long is the team going to let him try to figure that out at the major league level? And it's a particularly interesting question with him because he doesn't have anything else left to prove at AAA, right? Like, he can't get better teeing off against AAA pitching. He's already done the teeing off against AAA pitching. And the Orioles want to not just they don't just want to be a good team for the next 10 years with Jackson Holliday as a centerpiece of that. They want to win right now. They need to win baseball games right now. So they don't have a spot for him if he's striking out 50% of the time. That said, I am going to hold on Jackson Holliday at this moment in time, unless I'm so riddled with injuries and I just need someone who can play in that spot right now. Look, there comes a time on any roster, whether it's got injured list spots or not, you need a shortstop, and the shortstop you've got is in AAA. You have to make a decision. You can't just hold on to him indefinitely, even if you believe he's going to be the bee's knees in August and September. But Jackson Holliday is in that elite range of prospects where I'm holding on as long as humanly possible. And for the record, the other guys who are in that range for me, Paul Skeens is in that range for me. I drafted him in a handful of leagues. I've been holding on tight, praying that the injury situation doesn't get to the point where I have to drop him before he gets called up. Junior Caminero is in that range for me. I have Max Meyer in a handful of leagues. I'm holding on as tight as I can because he looked so good and the Marlins don't have pitching. Sixto Sanchez is out here losing games. And I'm like, you've got Max Meyer. He's right there. He should be pitching for you. So I'm holding on with Jackson Holliday. I believe in the talent. I think the second time through, he's going to crush it. But the first time through was rough and the Orioles have a lot of options. So it's, you got to be willing to wait.
All right, Shelley, your turn. 3 minutes. Are you dumping Jackson Holliday?
Yeah, I am. He's very young. He's very advanced for his age. But again, he was striking out 50% of the time. And even in minor league spring training, he had an elevated strikeout rate. I love Jackson Holliday. I think that he is going to be a dude. I don't think he's going to be a dude for this year. I don't know exactly what he can learn in AAA outside of prior to spring training. He had never hit a home run against a left-handed pitcher. So there is stuff that he still needs to learn because honestly, he's just a baby, honestly. While I think that long-term he's going to be great, I just don't think that he's ready this year. And especially in leagues where I don't have an IL spot, I'm not going to, quote unquote, like waste a roster spot when I have, I don't know, Royce Lewis on the IL or any other pitcher, Garrett Cole on the IL. I'm not going to just drop them for Jackson Holliday just for the hope and prayer, right, that he'll come back up and be dominant. I mean, I don't have him in any redraft leagues, so I would hate to drop him, but I think that is a smart move. And the Orioles as an organization are extremely deep. Like, they could totally bring up Coby Mayo right now to play second base. And while he has an elevated strikeout rate this year, he could still do something. And I just think that Jackson Holliday just needs a little bit more time. It was like really cool to see him for a little bit, but obviously with a 50% strikeout rate, he's not ready. I mean, he is totally dominating AAA. So again, like what Sarah was saying, I don't know what he can learn, but maybe he can learn something, because a 50% strikeout rate is honestly obscene. And I don't know, like, there's got to be something that he can learn down there to help with that. So yeah, if I had him on a redraft league, I sadly would be dropping him.
One of the things, Sarah, that you said, and this will kind of go into Q&A at this point, but was you'll try and hold on to him for as long as possible. For me, the hard part is we just don't, like, compared to like an injury stash with like a Garrett Cole, for example, we think we have a reasonable timeline for when they're going to come up. Obviously that can change, whatever, when they're going to return. Jackson Holliday, we don't have that. He could be in the minors for 2 weeks. He could be in the minors in AAA until September. Sarah, what's your cutoff? What's your over under for how long Jackson Holliday, if you knew today how long Jackson Holliday would be down in AAA before he gets called back up, what's your over under for how long you would be willing to stash him?
It's a really good question. I'm going to it's not a cop out, but this is just the honest answer. It really depends on your team context and your league situation. I am much more likely to cut him in an OC where it's a 12 team league and I have to churn those roster spots a little bit more quickly than I am in a 15 teamer where the odds that I'm going to find any middle infield eligible person I like half as much on the waiver wire are small. It also depends a lot on who you're holding and what you're holding out hope for. Like, if you have a team where you're holding on to Jackson Holliday and Paul Skenes and Max Meyer, something has gone wrong. You can't hold on to all three of those guys at the same time because you've broken your hold system, right? Like, if you have a team where you've got Justin Steele and he's coming back in a week and you've also got Jackson Holliday and all your other slots are fluid and you can move them around, it's a little bit different, right? I will say this. I would cut Jackson Holliday before I cut Mike Trout, before we know what's going on with Mike Trout and his knee injury. Like, I'm much more likely to hold on to a proven MLB talent who I know is going to come back in August and rake. But if I've got one stash right now and that stash is a guy who might come up and light the world on fire with his second look at big league pitching, I'm okay with that. If I'm at the point where my bench is just all injured guys and prospects and none of them can play, yeah, he's probably getting cut. And getting cut for, but getting cut for is the other part that I don't think we talk about enough. Like, who are you dropping? Because I don't think I want to drop Jackson Holliday for like Tim Anderson or Javier Baez right now. I mean, neither of those guys fills me with any sense of hope. And I love Javier Baez. I've got his bobblehead right behind me. Like, he is one of my all-time favorite players. And even with the playing time guarantee in Detroit, I think I'd rather take a chance on what Jackson Holliday can do as long as I have somebody who can fill that roster spot right now. If it's a question of like the Orioles call up Mayo or they call up somebody else Jordan Westberg becomes available or something, he's not going to become available. He's been playing too well, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm going for the other prospect and by Jackson Holliday, you will hopefully help somebody else's team.
So Sarah will not be picking up a Colorado Rocky for the week. And
absolutely not. Jackson Although Holliday. I did pick up Ryan McMahon for like 3 days to fill in for Manny Machado while he was on paternity leave. And then I got rid of Ryan McMahon.
See, there we go. You're coming around. I like to hear it. I like to hear my persuasive debate styles coming through. Any final rebuttals, Shelley? I'll go to you to wrap up the Jackson Holliday stash or not stash debate.
I love him. I just don't think that he's ready. And I think Baltimore's just hitting talent pool is so deep that they have so many other opportunities to mix and match before Jackson Holliday is ready this year. I hate to see it. I hope that he comes up next year and just totally dominates. And I think that he will. I just don't think that it's this year. A 50% K rate. What can you do with a 50% K rate?
Not much.
Yeah.
I'm not totally going to concede because I will still hold on to him as long as possible. But I will say this, Shelly, and Shelly knows this. Shelly is a person I go to for drop advice in our Twitter DM thread. So like, if I'm like, I have to drop Devin Williams, right? She's like, yes, because I'm bad at this. I want to hold on to everybody for as long as humanly possible. So that's maybe one of those situations where you should listen to Shelly. But if you have the stash spot available and there's no better option on the waiver wire, at least don't drop Jackson Holliday until you know there's a better option out there. I feel like sometimes we get so into there has to be a viable option that we forget that we're creating opportunity costs for ourselves. And in this particular instance, if that bench spot is not going to play anyway, at least hold on to the highest possible opportunity outcome. And in my opinion, Jackson Holliday is higher than a lot of other things you could do.
Agreed.
Yeah.
All right, moving right along here. Debate number three, I think Shelley is moderating this one as well.
Yeah, so with a recent Bloom board, we, you know, Ryan, you looked at some guys off to some very slow starts, although, you know, Anthony Rizzo answered the call with the player of the week. Like, he hit his, 300th career home run? Yeah. And I was just like, yes! Like, I was just, like, so excited. I'm just a massive Anthony Rizzo fan. I was really excited to see that. And then Francisco Lindor also went off, which totally helped with my 15-team tout draft that, Ryan, you're in that same league. I have just blew off the rackets with my, you know, moving up the ranks. And it's a lot of it had to do with Frankie Lindor. But let's look at some guys who are still struggling. Alex Bregman, who I do have in some dynasty leagues, and I'm honestly a little bit concerned, and especially with it being his walk year, right? He's currently slashing 216, 287, 268 with no home runs. And that was after two games in Mexico City. What do we do with Alex Bregman? Because he's had these up and downs, right? Well, he's had his downs, and then he just, like, goes off, right? Do we think that this is a down and then goes off? Or do we think this is a down and just duh, like a just a dud? So, Sarah, I will go with you.
So I was recently a guest with Scott Chu, our first guest on the show on Hacks and Jacks, and we talked about Bregman a little bit. And one of the things that Scott likes to always bring up, and he's absolutely right to do it, is rolling charts and looking at a player's 15-game rolling to try to get an idea of like, hey, is this a new thing that we're seeing right now, or is this a thing that is within the range of outcomes for this particular player? And one of the things that absolutely terrifies me about Alex Bregman, and it's in conjunction with what we heard from Jason Collette last week about the offensive environment and where things are at and what I know about Bregman's power, which I'll talk about in a second, is that if you look at Bregman's WOBA chart, it just dives off a cliff like it never has in his career at this moment in time, which leads me to believe not maybe that he's cooked, but that something is going on, whether it's injury, whether it's the offensive environment, whether it's the way he's hitting the ball or what is going on, that is structural and not merely a blip. And so there's a couple of things here that I think are worth pointing out that really just terrify me, frankly, about Alex Bregman right now. One is that he only has two barrels on the season in 85 batted ball events. I think that I read somewhere once upon a time that rate kind of stabilizes around 50 batted ball events. So that's concerning because that is less than half of his lowest. No, if you exclude 2020, if you exclude the shortened season, which I will for this purpose, because it doesn't make any sense to look at a 60-game sample, that's less than half of his lowest barrel rate ever. His lowest barrel rate, one of them prior to that, though, was 2023, where he had a 5.4% barrel rate. So this is kind of like just a continuing trend. And then the other thing that really terrifies me here, his hard hit rate is down to 34.1%. That's just not very good. He still doesn't strike out very much, but he's absolutely failing to turn the hits that he used to into extra base hits and home runs. And I just, could he snap out of it? Yes. But if Mexico didn't do it, like, what will?
I mean, go ahead.
You all have a lot of faith in Mexico to cure all ills here.
I am Mexican. I'm Mexican American. My family's from New Mexico. Like, we came Spain to Mexico. Anyway, we were Spanish, then we were Mexican, and now we're American, and we've just been here for 500 years. So I do have a lot of faith in Mexico. Viva Mexico.
Even in just two games. All right. So my rebuttal, I will start actually. So Shelley made the, or not my rebuttal, my initial case to follow the format. Shelley mentioned the Anthony Rizzo thing, and this was so. This question kind of came from a Bloomberg that I had on struggling mid round hitters, and at the time, Anthony Rizzo, I believe, was hitting, going back in memory here, hitting like 220 with one home run and seven RBI, and just went off on a heater, AL Player of the Week, and now Anthony Rizzo is hitting 267 with five home runs and 15 RBI. It just goes to show how early we are in the season, how one hot week can basically change anything that we know about a specific player. And I think, especially for these guys with long track records, like a Rizzo, like an Alex Bregman, I think you can just be in a slump sometimes. I think, you know, we want to overthink it. We want to look at barrel rates and strikeout rates and rolling wOBAs and all that kind of stuff. Skills can slump and surge just like results can. You can have a 2-month stretch where, yeah, you just don't barrel it up. It happens. And I think that's the case with Alex Bregman, given the track record that Bregman has shown. And it's actually interesting when you were talking, Sarah, about, and Scott Chu does excellent work with rolling graphs. He did a presentation at First Pitch last year that was just freaking awesome. Alex Bregman's rolling wOBA, I just have it up on Fangraphs. He actually had 2 points last season that were worse than what he's currently had so far in 2024. And I don't think we made that big of a deal out of it last year because it just happened in the middle of the season and you don't notice these things when it's July, August, whatever. So despite Alex Bregman being worse than he is now twice, last season, Alex Bregman still hit 262 with 25 home runs, which was basically a carbon copy of what he did the year before in 2022, which was 23 homers and 260. So is he off to a slow start? Yes. Do I think Alex Bregman bounces right back and returns to the hitter that he has been because of the track record? I will also say yes. I'm hedging that this is just a slump. It happens. Sometimes it happens in the middle of the year. Sometimes it happens at the beginning of the year.
Well, and to your point on the rolling graphs, because I'm looking at that too, it looks like that was at the start of the season, and then he kind of pulled it up right around the midpoint of April. And so what I'm trying to distinguish here and what I was looking at that really caught my attention, this is a longer slump than what he had at the start of 2023. Like if you hover over those dots, you could, yeah, he was a little bit lower April 331 and like April 9th of 2023. But by April 24th, he had pulled out of it. Here, he just kind of seems to keep going down. And I think that downward trend is what I'm a little bit concerned about. But I do hear you. He's been a good hitter his whole life. I just wonder, and maybe I'll just start the question and answer period here and ask you this question. For a guy like Alex Bregman, and we saw in the home run derby, like he is a pull power hitter who is always trying to just launch those home runs to the Crawford boxes, right? He's kind of one of those guys who barely hits a home run. Like the home runs he gets are the like wall scraping home runs. And we've seen this movie before. It was called DJ LeMahieu. When the ball changed and all of a sudden DJ LeMahieu went from being like a 20 plus home run guy to zip, nada, nothing. Those are all just flyouts. If the offensive environment, and admittedly, I'm about to do a lot of ifs here, but if the offensive environment has shifted and the ball is somehow less home runny, I don't know, less bouncy than it was before, I feel like Bregman is exactly the type of guy that we would see the sort of power outage from.
You are correct. I'm not sure that's a question at me, but I think that's a proper comment. And that you're right. Alex Bregman does make his living off of, you know, we talk about the barrels and whatnot. He does not barrel very much, but he knows how to get it over the Crawford boxes. And again, just barely. It's not like a Yordan Alvarez who, you know, if the ball is de-juiced or whatever the proper term is, Yordan Alvarez's 450-foot home runs only go 430. It doesn't really matter. I agree with you that Bregman would be affected, I think, more than most, because he does not barrel it up that often. He does take advantage of those pull fly balls and goes over the Crawford boxes. The DJ LeMahieu comp. That's a perfect comp, because he had that one year he just went opposite field and went right over that short porch, like barely. And I don't know how many home runs he hit in that. I think it was 2019, but it was a lot, and it has not had a lot since then.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, because I'm not an Astros fan or anything, but like, I don't want anyone to struggle in their walk year. I want baseball players to generally get paid for their labor and to do great things for their teams. And, you know, as long as you're not a Yankee or a Cardinal, noted exception Anthony Rizzo, who I will cheer for till the end of time. As long as you're not a Yankee, and Wilson Contreras and Juan Soto. The Yankees and Cardinals have messed everything up recently by signing some of my all-time favorites, but that's a debate for another day. As long as you're not like, you know, one of the evil Yankees or Cardinals, I'm generally here for your success. I just am a little concerned about Alex Bregman.
The last thing that I'll add that I didn't get to touch on is just Alex Bregman's a compiler. The runs in RBI are like huge for him. Last season, Alex Bregman had 103 runs, 98 RBI, and only hit .262. Somehow has only scored 4 runs all season. Like, yes, the Astros have been bad, but it's more so been their pitching than their hitting. I don't see the Astros lineup slumping this much all year. And I think the kind of the hidden value, the stats that we don't talk about as much with runs and RBI, I hope also go back in Alex Bregman's favor. So we'll see. It's been rough though.
Although, and I'm just going to call this my rebuttal and end it. If the Astros are not good, like if this is the denouement of the Astros dynasty, Alex Bregman as a compiler all of a sudden goes out the window, because he sort of relies on having that plus lineup all around him in order to compile those stats. And you can go from like a guy that gets 90 RBIs to a guy that gets 70 really fast if the guys around you are not producing at all.
That's a great point. I agree. That's the double-edged sword of being a compiler.
Yeah. Great stuff. Let's head into our next debate. I think I'm moderating this one, and good, because I've been debating a lot here today, and it's been a long work day, y'all. Joe Adell, who I have been in on a handful of times and was not in on at any point in time this year, and I'm not in on even the great start, although I wish all of you who are in on it luck, off to a great start this season. He's hitting .321, .373, .623 with 4 home runs and steals. The other thing I'll mention about Joe Adell, because I think it's relevant to what we were talking about earlier, we're finally seeing him at age 25, which is an age when a lot of guys come up to the majors for their first time. Some of the early iterations of Joe Adell, he was not age to level at Major League Baseball. He was definitely playing as a top tier prospect over his skis a little bit, a la Jackson Holiday. Maybe. Is this finally it for Joe Adell? Is this a real breakout? Do you believe? Are you invested? Shelley, we'll start with you.
No, I'll be the negative person. I don't think this is necessarily a quote-unquote breakout. While, yes, there have been some positive skills, like his K rate has dropped just from the MLB level from 40% last year to 23% this year. His swing and strikeout rate at the major league level has dropped from 18% to 12%. But I don't know if he's necessarily better. Yeah, he's hit 4 home runs. He's stolen 4 bases. He's hitting .321. That's great. I just don't necessarily believe it, because it just kind of honestly came from nowhere, because he has been, sadly, I hate to put him in this category. He was kind of like a quad A player to me, where he would demolish triple A. Or hit pretty well. And then whenever he would come up to the majors, he would just struggle. And yes, maybe he's obviously flipped the turn so far this year. But honestly, I haven't seen anything that changed. Like, I've looked at video. I mean, I'm not a scout by any means. I've looked at video. I don't see anything that he's doing differently. I haven't seen any beat writers report on any swing changes or any approach changes that he's done. Maybe it just hasn't been reported. I don't know. It just seems like an extremely hot streak to me. I mean, I love to see it. I mean, I've always rooted for Adele since he was like a top prospect back in the day. And just seeing someone like him just struggle because he was like brought up in the 2020 season when he obviously wasn't ready. The Angels were trying to go for it, and they just doesn't seem like the Angels were really looking to help Adele be like the best player. They just was trying to ride a hot streak just to get to the playoffs or something like that. So with the Angels kind of with losing Mike Trout, as we were talking about earlier today, honestly, I think Mike Trout is like Joe Adele is like the best hitter on that team, which kind of scares me a bit. So I don't know. I honestly don't believe it. I need to see a little bit more of a sample size to believe in all of the changes without hearing or seeing anything different that he is doing.
It's a great point on the Angels themselves and them not being awesome at player development and any number of other things. Ryan, what do you think about the Joe Adele post hype sleeper role? Is this finally it?
I think probably define what it means. Like, yeah, I'm not saying major breakout or anything like that, but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be for Joe Adele. Like, the expectations for Joe Adele were just so high that, like, you know, we frame it as a breakout, but like, he could just end up being like pretty decent this year. And I think that's a win for Joe Adele. It's interesting to hear Shelley's notes on the kind of the lack of any kind of tangible change or approach change. That's interesting to me. And Shelley, I certainly trust your, what you're hearing and your contacts and that sort of thing. So that similar to what I was said about Bregman also applies to Joe Adele. Like, for as bad as you can be for a month, you can also be really good for a month. And it's just a hot streak. That said, with Joe Adele, Shelley already kind of mentioned this, but age 25, like we're kind of talking like the book has been written on Joe Adele and Quad A. Like, I get that Joe Adele has always been pretty darn good in AAA. But I think it's a little early to label him a Quad A. I think you got to be like 27, 28 until we go there. For as tough as the Mike Trout news is, Joe Adele is going to get everyday run. He's hitting second. That's one thing that, like, he's been jerked around throughout his career and just kind of deservedly so in the majors, but like, he was not Joe Madden's favorite player. He was not Phil Nevin's favorite player. He would come up, and the defense admittedly was pretty bad, but he would come up for a few games, get sent back down. He'd get called up, not play, get sent back down. He has never really had a prolonged chance. Adele has to actually show what he can do. And I think he's going to get that under a new manager in Ron Washington. I know that is like kind of narrative-based analysis, but I do think a changing of the guard from a manager standpoint, having Ron Washington there and them giving Joe Adele what looks like a pretty long leash to see what he can actually do in the majors, he has not really been given that chance before. So for all those reasons, I think Joe Adele, like, no, realistically, I'm not going to say breakout, but I think he can be pretty darn good this year.
It's an interesting point that you bring up about the changing of the guard, because I have noticed a handful of things that are just different about the Angels this year. Frankly, it makes them more watchable than they have been in previous iterations. And I say that as a person who loves Joe Madden and will always be grateful for 2016, but it just really wasn't that watchable of a team under Joe Madden. I wonder, Shelley, you mentioned that there's not much that Joe Adele looks to be doing differently. And I agree with you on just about everything there, with one exception. And that is the strikeout rate, which is down from, you know, he struck out 37.5% of the time in 2022. He struck out 40.3% of the time, tiny sample size of 62 plate appearances in 2023. It's down to 23.7% of the time, again, tiny sample size of 59 plate appearances right now. But that is right around where the strikeout rate gets kind of sticky. If Joe Adele is striking out less, and I agree with everything you said about the luck metrics and all of those types of things, but if he's striking out less, he's probably at least somewhat better than what we've seen before, right?
Yes, yes, I do agree. Like, what I have seen so far from him has been pretty good. Like, his zone contact rate has been up. His outside of the zone swing rate has been down. I mean, that's exactly what you want to see. So, yes, metrically, things have changed. I just don't know what he's changed other than maybe it's two or three balls, right, that he hasn't swung at and he didn't make contact. You know, it's just like some of these things that I'm just not, I don't know. I want this to be true. I really do. I've always loved Joe Adell. And like, I did think that he kind of got like a bad rap from the 2020s to the 2022-2023 season, where the Angels were trying to compete and he just kind of bumbled like some balls and had a bad game, and then they would just demote him. And just the up and down nature of heck being in LA and then Salt Lake City, and then just all of just that moving around and not feeling quote unquote like loved within your organization. I can totally get it. So I really hope this is a thing. I just, sadly, I need to see more, because I'm just like, this is such a stark change from what we've seen from the last two seasons. And I don't see any evidence of any written evidence or anything that I have looked at that he has changed to explain this other than a hot month and a half.
It's a good point. It's also a great reminder, Salt Lake City, if they ever get a team, that's your New Mexico City, Colorado type of environment. Like, this poor guy was getting bounced back and forth between the marine layer and like mountain air. And that is just a very difficult thing to do. Ryan, you mentioned something that I want you to talk about a little bit more. It's not as much of a question, but I just want you to expand on it, because this is one of the reasons that in a lot of my fab leagues this last weekend, I went after Mike Tauchman, not because I believe Mike Tauchman is suddenly a different player, but because he's hitting second for a Chicago Cubs team that is pretty good. And with the injuries that Cody Bellinger and Seiya Suzuki have suffered, hitting second for a good lineup for a couple of months is a really nice attribute to have, regardless of anything else. And it seems like, whether you believe in Joe Adell or not, that attribute of he hits second for a team that is not the Rockies is good enough.
They are enabling him. They are enabling Joe Adell, and not only from a lineup standpoint and an everyday playing time standpoint, they're letting him run too. He's already had 9 stolen base attempts. He's only been successful on 5 of them, but this is another like Ron Washington letting, you know, let the kids play. Like, I think they're just letting Joe Adell. It's a change in approach with how they're handling him. And so I think that's just another kind of feather in the Joe Adell cap for a breakout. I'll wrap up the Q&A part with this, with a question on Joe Adell's rest of season steamer projection. So from FanGraphs, Steamer's saying Joe Adell 420 plate appearances the rest of the way to hit 230, 19 homers and 12 steals. Shelly, since I'm debating you, I'm assuming you'll take the under, but what do you think of that projection?
Outside of the plate appearances, under. Like, I just think that there's going to be a massive regression, sadly.
Fair enough. Sarah, what do you think?
I actually think that 19-12 number is about right. I mean, that would put him at what, like 23 home runs, 16 steals on the season. Mm-hmm. I actually might take the over on steals. I think that he might get, I think he's more likely to get to 20 plus steals, just given the way the Angels are playing the running game, than he is to get to 20 plus homers, given who the Angels are and who mm-hmm. Joe Adell is. But mm-hmm. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that given all of that playing time, he becomes a 2020 guy by the end of the season. Admittedly, it might be a 2020 guy who strikes out 35% of the time with a 230 batting average, but he could be 2020.
Yeah. Fair. But that kind of goes back to what I was saying too, is it doesn't have to be like this massive breakout guy, but if Joe Adell can go 2020, like that's a nice step forward from where he's been. So,
yeah, I agree with that. We are going to take one more quick break for our sponsors. On the flip side, we have a couple more debates. We also have our love it or leave it. Come right back. All right, we're back. Shelly, you've got our next debate as the moderator.
Yeah. So two guys that I was massively wrong about, Jordan Hicks and Reynaldo Lopez, like two guys who were signed as starters after being relievers for the last couple years for Jordan Hicks and, you know, the last, I guess, couple years for Reynaldo Lopez as well. And honestly, when I saw the news that they signed as starters, I kind of scoffed at it and laughed at it. I'm like, what are the Giants doing here? What are the Braves doing here? This doesn't make any sense, whatever. These two guys have just been just freaking awesome. Like, I have Jordan Hicks in like one redraft league, and it was like a really late round pick. And I was just like, yeah, whatever. There's no good starters available. I need a starter, whatever. And he has been like one of my best starters. I don't have Lopez anywhere, but I'm just like curious about what you guys think about one, both these players going forward. And then two, do you think that the whole transitioning from reliever to starter is a thing, or is this just a fluke because of just like workload concerns and, you know, player pitchers like pitching to their max all the time? Maybe a reliever can go 3 or 4 innings and become a quote unquote starter. Do you think that that's applicable in fantasy going forward? I know I'm just like throwing like two questions at you, but Ryan, what do you think?
I think, and like Garrett Crochet is another example. I know he's been a little shaky lately, but like I was very skeptical of the Jordan Hicks and Reynaldo Lopez transition from rotation. We're just so ingrained in that mindset of like, oh, you know, the reliever can't transition to a starter and pitch, you know, 180, 200 innings. They don't need to now. Like I trust what the Giants are doing, what the Braves are doing. They know what they're doing with these guys more than we do from our couch. So there's that. I will be on the pro Jordan Hicks side here, though I do like them both. I think this is all intentional by the Giants in terms of getting a ton of ground ball pitchers. So we're seeing it with Logan Webb, with Keaton Wynn, with if he comes back this year, Alex Cobb, and Jordan Hicks, who has a 60% ground ball rate. They have surrounded Jordan Hicks with an elite left side of the infield. Nick Ahmed, shortstop. Granted, can't hit, so for fantasy, like that doesn't help us, but it really helps. It really helps Jordan Hicks and then Matt Chapman at third base. Like having that infield defense around these ground ball guys, I think is very intentional for what San Francisco wants to do. So, like, yes, is Jordan Hicks going to hold a 1.59 ERA sub-1 WHIP the rest of the year? No. Like, I still think there are some pretty major control concerns. But when you start getting up to a 60% ground ball rate, Jeff Zimmerman has wrote about this in The Process, like your return on that ground ball rate actually starts getting exponential once you go above 50%. So once you get into 60%, it is just so many balls on the ground that it's I don't want to say impossible. It's very hard to have a bad ERA when you have that many balls on the ground. We see it with Framber Valdez all these years. So that's the main reason for me taking Jordan Hicks over Lopez, at least for this year. He's also 3 years younger, which I think matters here as well. So it's my case for Mr. Hicks.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. I mean, we're only one Nick Ahmed injury away from that not being a thing anymore.
That's true. Kidding,
Ryan. But go ahead. Sarah, what do you – I guess you got the Lopez side of this. What you got?
So this is wild, and I just want to echo what y'all were saying earlier. I was not into this. I was like, there's no way – these guys who were middle relievers or closers in the case of Hicks are going to all of a sudden be like lockdown starters. It doesn't make any sense. And I'm just going to do a mea culpa here for a second, because it absolutely does make sense for a handful of relievers with a certain specific quality, which is they have 4 pitches or more that they can actually throw in a game and get outs with. I think that this does not make sense for the guys who are relievers who are like 2-pitch wonders, or like the only reason they're getting outs at all is because they throw 100 plus miles an hour, and once the shine's off that rose, they can't do it anymore. Once the command fails, they can't do it anymore. I think that for a certain subset of relievers who are like, no, they're really 4-pitch guys, and just an injury or some bad circumstances or something push them to the pen at some point in time, this seems to be a viable thing. And for a game where starting pitchers are getting hurt all of the time. And we've already talked on the show about like the motion of pitching is just designed to hurt you. And the fact that guys keep trying to do it harder with more spin and less resources to do that in terms of sticky stuff and time and everything else, it seems destined to injure people. So if you can go to that pool of guys who already have major league ready stuff and multiple pitches to try to turn them into starters, I think that is a viable thing now. I like Ronaldo Lopez more than I like Jordan Hicks, although not by a lot. This isn't like a don't, I'm out on Hicks type of thing. I agree with a lot of what Ryan said about the Giants circumstances, what they're trying to do, Hicks and his ground ball rate, etc. The thing I like about Ronaldo Lopez a little bit more, I like the team context more for getting wins for starts. I think that the Braves are going to put Ronaldo Lopez in a situation where he can get more wins than the Giants are going to put Jordan Hicks into a situation where he can get wins. And I don't really trust the Giants to let Jordan Hicks stay in the game if it looks like there's any hint of a third time through the order penalty type of thing coming down the pike. So I just think Ronaldo Lopez is going to get more W's. But the other thing I really like about Ronaldo Lopez from what I've seen so far this year is that he's changed his pitch mix. So he's throwing that curveball more frequently, and batters, at least so far, have not adapted to that. So he's using his curveball more. He's getting more outs on that. And finally, the thing that jumps out at me with both of these guys, like, yeah, they're over their skis a little bit. Their ERAs are overperforming their FIP, but I don't know, man. Jordan Hicks has an ERA of 1.59 off a 3.10 FIP right now. Mm-hmm. You would take a 3.10 ERA too. And Reynaldo Lopez has a 0.72 ERA off a 2.72 FIP. So look, Ronaldo Lopez by a hair, but both of these guys look like pretty good pitchers, and you could do worse on your fantasy teams.
They've both taken considerable velocity off their fastball too. Hicks is down 5 miles an hour, which sounds like terrible. The world's going to end, but that's what you want. And Ronaldo Lopez is down 3 miles an hour, I believe. So very good points. I do still wonder, like, in the second half, if we're still talking about these guys, but it's been quite the impressive start for both.
That's a great point on the velocity, because I think both of them, I mean, obviously you just can't sustain the type of velocity that Jordan Hicks in particular had.
Right. Yes.
As just like a one inning guy, right? Like, this is the difference between sprinting and running a marathon. Like, these are just very different activities. And if you try to do one for the duration of the other, it is probably not going to work unless you are a freak of nature. And there are some of those in MLB, but Hicks and Lopez do not seem to be those guys.
The last thing I'll bring up, you mentioned the pitch mix on Ronaldo Lopez's side, Sarah. So I have to do Jordan Hicks justice as well. Throwing basically a brand new split finger 22% of the time. And it is his by far biggest swing and miss pitch. So fading the four seamer, throwing far fewer sinkers. That usage is down from like 65 down to 50% this year, and filling that in with splitters, which he did not show last year. So that kind of goes to what you were saying about, you know, having multiple pitches is really like of the utmost importance if you're going to go into the rotation.
Yeah. And I think being able to like learn, like one of the things that I was listening to, I think it was Eno talking about earlier this week when they were talking to Adam Ottavino on Rates and Barrels. And he was talking about teams are just getting a lot smarter at seeing, hey, you throw out of this arm slot, so it looks like you could throw this other type of pitch. And that therefore guys are able to develop other pitches more efficiently than maybe they were able to in the past. I remember once upon a time absolutely marveling at Yu Darvish developing a knuckle curve within a week of Craig Kimbrell joining the Cubs. And he's like, he like threw it in a game. And I was like, what is this? Who, you learned a pitch in a week? Like, that's crazy. But it does seem like with all the data and analytics we have now, guys can add to their repertoire a little bit easier. And that is something that's happening in these instances too. I don't know if we just agreed, so I don't know if we need rebuttals anymore, but I will be more, if next year I hear, like, I don't know, Matt Strom's going to be converted into a starter, I'll be like, I'm in. Let's go.
They're similar. I mean, in all honesty, I had trouble like picking a side on this one. They're very similar. I have the same like concerns with both, but I also think both have taken like a very much skill supported step forward so far.
Congratulations to all the Ronaldo Lopez and Jordan Hicks people in the land. You are winning.
Not us.
We were out and we were wrong. Oh, wow. our last debate today is going to be moderated by our guest, Ryan. Take us into our last debate.
All right, a little bit of a fun one, non-fantasy related question, but it's some Hall of Fame debate. Sal Perez having another great season where it seems like he gets injured like every other game and then just back in the starting lineup at 1 p.m. the next day. Is he a Hall of Famer? Is he a Hall of Famer? Over Sal Perez's 13-year career, he's hit .268 with a .302 on base and a .462 slugging percentage, World Series title, catcher. I'll start with you, Sarah, who or which side of the Hall of Fame coin are you on with Sal Perez?
So I admit that I am not a person who votes for the Hall of Fame or like has any cred for why I should be able to talk about the Hall of Fame or anything like that. This is a little bit out of my own wheelhouse, but I do love catchers. They are, it's like my all-time favorite position, and I tend to like wind up Wilson Contreras, man. Like if you follow me on Twitter, you know, like I'm just into catchers who rake. And Salvador Perez is a catcher who rakes. And the Kansas City Royals did something really smart with Salvador Perez, which is they doubled down on him as their franchise guy. And I love it when you have a franchise guy. I love it when you have a franchise guy who has won with your team. And I love it when you have a franchise guy who is going out on a high note. And I kind of feel like what we're seeing from Salvador Perez is the exact opposite of what we see from a ton of catchers. And so I'm going to use that as a reason that if I were lucky enough to ever get a ballot for Cooperstown someday, I think I'm voting Salvador Perez into the Hall. Catching is a weird position. You have lots of duties that go beyond just picking up a bat and hitting a baseball. You have to be able to game call. You have to be able to game plan. You have to be able to frame. You have to be able to throw guys out. You have to be able to squat for 9 innings every other day, sometimes back-to-back days, for 6 months. And like, I just want to say, like, if you ever take an opportunity to get into a catcher position and see how long you can hold it, imagine doing that over and over and over again for like large portions of your life. It's just impossible to imagine. It's part of the reason that catchers are, I truly believe, superhumans in my mind. And I think we should respect the ones who do it for a tremendously long period of time and do it well. Salvador Perez is an unorthodox case for the Hall of Fame for sure. His career numbers are probably going to line up weirdly against other guys who are going to go into the Hall because they're kind of like, I don't know, you see all these defensive specialists. I mean, we're going to have a whole debate about Yadier Molina someday. But at 33 years old, Salvador Perez has spent 14 years in the big leagues, and he's done it to the tune of a .268, .302, .462 slash line with 253 home runs. He stacks up within the range of guys in JAWS, which is the metric that Jay Jaffe uses to measure players off their peak on a career basis for the Hall. And he's not like in a sea of Hall of Famers, but he's right over, he's ahead of guys who got it, which leads me to believe that when we come to the day where Salvador Perez is on the ballot, he probably doesn't go in on the first ballot. He might not even go in on the second ballot, but people are going to kind of look around. They're going to be like, yeah, but he did it not quite as well as Buster Posey or Joe Mauer, but he did it for much longer. And he was certainly better than Yadier Molina. And I think he gets in.
Ooh, some Yadier Molina shade from a, from
I mean, a I'm a Cubs
fan. So surprised. I'm so surprised.
It's shocking. Although I will say, before I turn it over to Shelly, the current iteration of the Cardinals are making the case that Yadier Molina was in fact a Hall of Famer.
Was in fact. Like, now,
I've
now
never seen a franchise fall apart so fast.
Things have gone south very quickly since Yadi has left. All right, Shelly, what's your case against Salvador Perez?
I mean, I'm a humongous Sal fan. I honestly do think that he is a Hall of Famer. But I mean, if you are a person who looks at, you know, WAR or JAWS, like Sarah was saying, I mean, Sal is currently the 32nd ranked catcher on JAWS's, you know, list. And he's behind, you know, Victor Martinez. Do you think that Victor Martinez is a Hall of Famer? I think that he's a really, really good player, but I don't think he's necessarily a Hall of Famer. I think Salvador Perez is a guy who should be in the Hall of Fame, but maybe not plaque worthy. He is a good player. Like, again, like he won a World Series. He just everything that he's done has been great. I just don't know if it's necessarily Hall of Fame worthy. I mean, Buster Posey's probably going to go in, right? Those are the guys that we're coming up with. Buster Posey, Molina, stuff, you know, guys like that. Russell Martin is actually ahead of him in the Jaws ranking, which honestly shocked me. Again, like there is like defensive stuff that plays into Jaws and all that. And defensive stuff just kind of is a little bit fluky. But I think he's, you know, Hall of like extremely good, not even really good, just Hall of extremely good. I just don't know if he's Hall of Fame worthy.
He'll be right down the street from Cooperstown in the Hall of Extremely Good. It's not quite there, but yeah. All right, Sarah, Q&A.
Okay, so I have a question for you because one, I was looking at where he lives on this ranking too, and I agree with you on the Victor Martinez comp. I think that's a strong one, particularly because they're both sort of similar guys in that like their offense over defense, and like although let's be honest, Victor Martinez was a bad defender, and Salvador Perez is at least kind of passable.
Yeah, sure. And a DH for a lot of his career too.
Yep. The thing that kind of pushes me over the like Salvador Perez line, and he overcomes Victor Martinez, in my opinion, is Victor Martinez had like 500 more games than Salvador Perez. Let's imagine 500 more games of Salvador Perez, because that would actually put them retiring at about the same time Martinez retired when he was 37. Salvador Perez is raking right now. Like, does anybody really? I don't know, man. Like, there's something in the water in that house, because he should not be able to keep doing what he's doing. And yet, here he is, 33 years old, hitting the same way Buster Posey did at the end of his career. Like, it's crazy to me. Salvador Perez might be timeless. If he does this for 3 more years, he surpasses Victor Martinez easily.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. What he's doing this year is like boggling my mind. I have been betting against this guy for years. I mean, honestly, since his like 2020 season, I'm like, because I play in way too many OBP leagues, and I'm just like, I cannot stomach like a 299 OBP, right? Even though his career OBP is over 300, which honestly kind of shocked me knowing as much OBP leagues I've played. I'm like, I always just thought he was a 280, 290 guy. But anyway, go ahead. I just think that what this year has just been absolutely bonkers. Like, he has 11% K rate, nearly 8% walk rate, and he's just going out of his mind. So yeah, maybe it's that swan song Buster Posey year, but I'm just like, as much as I love him to death, right? I just like, he would have to do this for maybe another year, maybe another 2 years before I put him in Hall of Fame territory. He's really Hall of Great, but not Hall of Fame. And it really makes me sad because I love the dude. Like, he plays, he's gritty. He plays every day. He doesn't matter if his whatever hurts. You know what Ryan said, like, he gets nicked one day, he comes out of the game, and then he comes right back in the next day. Like, he's extremely durable for a catcher. I find it really hard to quite put him above that mark.
I agree with you that if his career ends today, he's probably out. Sure. I also at this point feel like, and I too, by the way, have been betting against Salvador Perez in like every draft for, I don't know, like at least 4 or 5 years. Because why would I take Salvador Perez when I could take Wilson Contreras 8 rounds later? It just seemed like an obvious choice. Salvador Perez currently has an on-base percentage of .404. And it looks like he might hit 40 home runs again. And I'm just like, I don't know if that's who he is going to be as he goes out, right? Like, I think back to with 8 years left in his career. And there are not 8 years left in Salvador Perez's career, so let's be clear on that. But with eight years or so left in his career, people were kind of meh on Adrian Beltre. It was like, it's not going to be a thing. Not going to be a thing. Like, he's good. He's very good. We like him. And then he just kept doing it for the rest of his career. Shelley, I guess my question for you is, if we get 3 more years, given catcher age rates and like how short their careers are generally and all that type of stuff, where Salvador Perez puts up 30 plus home runs and just posts, I think he's in.
Sure. Yeah. I just don't know if he actually does that. I mean, again, he's 34. And I have a really soft spot for catchers because I always wanted to catch in softball, but my family wouldn't let me because I was too small. So I always have like this really soft spot for catchers that I just love them because they could do something that I couldn't do. But I'm just like, yeah, he just needs like a couple more years. Can he do that? Maybe he could. Maybe he could, because when has he not? Like, he always posts. And even if he goes to like DH, yeah, the WAR will go down, the jaws probably score will go down, but if he still posts like 25, 30 home runs, yeah, sure, 100%. Yeah. I just don't know if he can, because he has just so many games on those legs, and it's just like, oi, I don't even know how he's doing it at the age of 34.
Yeah, that's the thing. He's proven us wrong like his entire career so far. So I don't know. I agree. As the impartial moderator to this one, I would punt and say it depends on his last 2-3 years what that looks like.
Oh, but it's going to be so fun to watch. And the last thing I'll say about this, and then we can move into Love It or Leave It. The Royals have, they keep trying to replace him, and Salvador Perez just holds the game.
Don't go away. Yeah.
Like, MJ Melendez was supposed to be the replacement. Yeah. They're like, yeah, you can be in the outfield. Like, we're just going to stick with Sal. Like, Freddie Fermin had Freddie a shot Fermin, to yep. like, and no, nope, nope. Here comes Salvador Perez is like, nope, I'm putting on the gear. I'm just going out and posting. So yep. I do think that if he just keeps doing that through a couple more Royals backup catchers, it's probably a situation where he's in the hall at the end of the day. And that'll be fun, because I like it when gritty guys win.
Yep.
Yep.
All right, we are going to move into our Love It or Leave It. Ryan, as our guest, you get to kick us off. One thing from baseball this week that you loved and or hated.
I'm glad that they're leaving it, but I love that they're doing it. Major League Baseball, or at least the MLBPA, or someone announced that these horrid new uniforms are going away. At some point. That's my only hedge here. Is like, it could be next season. We don't exactly know when, but either way, it was it's funny how like anytime there's a new uniform or something or new logo, like usually people are skeptical, but you kind of get used to it. Never got used to these new uniforms, the see-through pants, the tiny letters, the sweat. It's not even, we were talking about monthly park factors with Coors earlier in the show. Like, imagine this summer with those uniforms. So that's my biggest love it from this week, is that those, I can't curse on this podcast, those ugly uniforms are going away. That's awesome to me.
They are the absolute worst, and I'm so glad they're going away. And I want the satin numbers back. I want the big letters back. Mm-hmm. I want the stitching. Mm-hmm. Like, I was looking at some of the stitching detail on uniforms, and it was gone on the Cubs uniform, and that killed me. But then I saw like what the Phillies used to have and what the Cardinals used to have, and I'm like, how do you take away those type of details from major league players and fans? How dare you? I agree with you 100%, the uniforms were the worst. And I love how the Players Association put out the release. MLB didn't really say much. Fanatics was like, we definitely didn't do this. We were just following orders. And Nike said nothing.
Yeah. The blame game is going around. But at the end of the day, if they're gone, I'm happy.
Yep. 10-10, recommend. Shelly, what is your Love It or Leave It this week?
My Love It or Leave It. I'm going to go with love, and it's Ellie De La Cruz. I tune into pretty much every single Cincinnati Reds game because Ellie is being quote unquote capital letters Ellie. And he's just amazing to watch. Whenever he gets on base, I'm just like, he's going to steal second base. He's going to steal third base. Heck, he might even steal home base. Like, I just find him fascinating, amazing. Yeah, maybe he's going to go into a slump here and there during summer, whatever. But some of the underlying metrics, like his decision when batting has been better, like not swinging in certain counts and not swinging outside the zone and all this other stuff has been better. But this is just kind of like, I remember watching Ellie in AA and AAA. And this is the Ellie that I saw. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is absolutely fun. I want to watch him every night. So my Love It or Leave It is just Ellie and the Cincinnati Reds. I will watch them forever just to see whatever
Ellie does. He has 18 stolen bases in a month, which is out of control. Crazy. I haven't done like the pace on that, but I see no reason why it's going to slow down. Like, he just gets, you're absolutely right. He gets on base, he's going to run. Good luck trying to throw him out. You probably can't. 18 stolen, absolutely bonkers possible numbers from Ellie De La Cruz. Ryan, were you in on Ellie this season?
That's the not ironic thing, but the bittersweet thing, I guess, is a better word. No, I was not, but I don't really care because we are watching like greatness and elite talent.
Right.
And anytime you get a chance to do that in any sport, you have to appreciate it while we have it. So it's been a ton of fun, even if it's hurting my fantasy teams. It's so much fun to watch them.
It's hurting my fantasy teams too, and I agree with you 100%. My love it or leave it for this week is we just saw the Cubs play a series at Fenway for the first time since 2017. I had the great fortune of being able to watch the Red Sox play at Wrigley Field a couple of years ago. It was so fun. And I just have to say, the universe deserves a Cubs-Red Sox World Series. The modern media game deserves a Cubs-Red Sox World Series. This is not something anyone who is alive most likely has really seen, because the last time it happened was 1918. I guess there are like five or six people in existence who might have been alive when there was a Cubs Red Sox World Series. But those people also, like, there were no TVs, there were no blogs, there was no Twitter, there was no any of it. They're such special parks. Fenway and Wrigley just have this character and oldness and quaintness and historicity to them that like nothing else has. And the fan bases are unique. And I had, you know, I'm not gonna like name names or shame anybody, but I had somebody in my mentions when I tweeted this earlier this week say, yeah, it's the same as the Yankees Dodgers World Series. It absolutely is not. The Yankees, Dodgers, Cardinals, all the other great teams, like, this is no shade to any of those teams except maybe the Yankees and the Cardinals. Like, none of them have that same character of, we waited decades for this, we play in the best parks and we know it, and we actually kind of like each other. Like, I've never really met Cubs fans who hate Red Sox fans and vice versa. I will never forget getting off the tee at Kenmore the first time I got to see the Cubs play at Fenway. I was wearing my Giovanni Soto jersey. It was 2011, and it was like the first time the Cubs had played there in 86 years. I'm walking off the tee, and this guy in a Red Sox cap looks at me and just says, hey, we hope you're next. He said it with an extreme Boston accent that I can't mimic, so I'm not going to, but it was great. And there's just a kindred spirit there. There's a little bit of like, we all have good food and we all have good vibes and we all have the working class culture thing going on. And anyway, baseball needs a Cubs Red Sox World Series, and I will die on this hill.
Even if one of the games is 17-0?
Even if one of the games is 17-0, even if, God forbid, the Cubs lose in seven, I think that would be, I mean, I couldn't even, I had moments this week where I was like, the Cubs were down 17. Christopher Morel is off the field looking like he might be injured for weeks. He was not, by the way. But, and I'm just like, oh, but Sadon Rafael is having a great game, and I kind of love that for him. And they're singing Sweet Caroline in the bleachers, so I can't hate that.
I'm impartial to both. It's a good take. I agree with the take for sure.
Ryan, we are so grateful that you took so long today to join us. We're a little bit over time, and I hope that nobody is up against it here. Where can people find your work? How can they follow you? The Bloom boards and your work at Baseball HQ are incredible. Help people find it.
Yeah, this has been a ton of fun. As much fun as listening to it, for sure. You can find my stuff at Baseball HQ. I'm on Twitter at RyanBHQ, and I co-host the Bubba and the Bloom podcast, which we do episodes that come out Wednesday morning and Friday mornings. I always get my days mixed up. So check us out on your podcast feeds or YouTube streams at Bubba and the Bloom. So thank you both so much. This was a ton of fun.
Awesome stuff. And yeah, we had a blast debating all of this with you. And Bubba and the Bloom podcast is must listen or must stream, and however you like to follow it. They stream on Twitter, they stream on YouTube. Like, it's great. It's a great time. Great time was had by all. Shelley, what have you been up to, and where can people follow you?
I've been here. Outside that, I missed the podcast last week. I missed you guys.
We missed you.
I missed you guys. But yeah, basically, I'm just here now with my baseball stuff. And but, you know, I post things occasionally on Twitter, ShelleyV_643. But again, I just love being on this podcast. And thank you, Sarah, for inviting me on this. this.
Oh my gosh. Journey. I couldn't do this without you. It's the most fun that I have every single week. As always, I am Sarah Sanchez at BCB underscore Sarah. There is no H on the Sarah, wherever you are on the socials. You can find my Cubs writing at bleedcubbyblue.com. You can find my fantasy takes at Baseball HQ, and you can find me each week here on the Pitcherless Network with Fantasy Feud. Please leave a rating and subscribe if you like the show, because it helps people find it. And we're still relatively new, so that helps us out. Until next time.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.